supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
They don't have a stable way of getting food.
The Department of Public Welfare says it plans to work with the federal government to speed up processing of disability applications and look for other ways to help former general assistance recipients. But it says don't expect cash benefits to return. I'm Carolyn Beeler, WHYY News.
In sports, Marlins beat the Phils 2-1, and the Union meet the Crew at 7:30 tonight. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a double-barreled question of the week for you later in the show. One listener wants to know what are the best compost bin designs that he can use to build a better composter. Another listener wants to buy the best pre-made composter. We'll lead you down the garden path about both after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sharon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I have a simple question, but the answer may not be so simple. It's the infamous barberry bush. Now, our barberry bush isn't really very big. It's a small front lawn, but of course the problem is those thorns. I have looked at various types of gloves online, and they're very expensive. Do you have any perhaps cheap suggestions, or maybe any sort of special type of pruner that might help?
Now, where are you?
I'm in Philadelphia.
You're in Philadelphia. Where?
In University City.
Okay, West Philadelphia.
Yes.
Yeah. So you have a barberry bush in the front of your house.
Yeah, it's not like it's real big, but it's some of it is intertwined with the hedges, so it's not like it's standing by itself. But, you know, the stalks grow and they have to be trimmed, and sometimes it's lower, and, of course, you know, the thorns.
And typically when do you prune it?
As soon as the stalks become high enough.
So you don't follow any seasonal rule?
No.
I hope you don't prune it in the fall.
Well, because the stalks got really high.
Yeah, well, they'll do that. One of the things that I'm going to advise here is you do a lot of pruning in the winter when the plant will be dormant and it won't be so crowded. There won't be so much else around. In terms of the kinds of gloves, I have one of these things, and I don't even really wear heavy-duty gardening gloves. What I use, because I would always take my gloves off and throw them on the ground, is I use baseball batting gloves. I go out and I'll buy like 3 pair of batting gloves every season, and I find that they cover your hands, they protect your hands, and they slip on and off. And they are so tight, they're so comfortable, I can answer my cell phone. I can dial my cell phone without taking my gloves off. Now, they don't offer a lot of protection. And I'm presuming your arms are getting scratched up?
Yes.
When my wife used to go out and pick raspberries, she used to save my old gym socks that had gone bad at the bottom, but the tube itself was still good, and she would pull 3 or 4 of those over her arms.
That's a great idea.
A corollary to that would be to get an old sweatshirt. The heavier, the better. The more beat up, the better. And to actually get a nice long pair of gloves and use rubber bands or something to make sure that everything is secure, that you like you got a onesie on.
Okay.
And then, in addition, I might not go in there with hand pruners. I might go in there with what's called a lopper, a long-handled pruner.
Okay.
That allows you to get deeper into the plant, open it up more, and really do the work while you're still at arm's length. They're also just remarkably handy tools for taking small limbs off trees and shrubs in the springtime, for instance, or in the winter, I often have like a big lopper on one side of my belt and a hand pruner on the other side, and I'll go back and forth between them. They're both great pruning tools.
That sounds like a good idea. I think, though, we'll have to, just for the sake of safety, there are a few more stalks that have to be cut off, and then in the winter time, I'll go into the lawn and see if I can cut back, like you're suggesting that we do. And also, I had bought a pair of thorn-proof gloves at a reputable garden supply store, and didn't work.
I think what you need for something like that is the kind of gloves that a person uses who works with hot metals, like a blacksmith glove, or the people who bend neon. They have these gloves that are totally impenetrable.
You've really given me some really helpful ideas. I especially like the idea of that loper, because I can use it for other things and save some money that way by getting it.
You'll wonder what you ever did without it.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, good luck. 1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am doing very well. Jack, how are you, sir?
Good. I have a question that maybe you can help me out with. Recently, my fiance and I went down to the Outer Banks, and we saw, well, she spied this little shrubbery-type tree. Turned out to be a crepe myrtle, and she loved it. Well, her birthday's in about a week. I do not have a green thumb, and I want to surprise her. I want to shop for one and plant it in the front yard.
Okay. Now, where are you?
Claymont, Delaware.
Okay. So, crepe myrtles are interesting plants. They are southern plants. It's funny you were down at the Outer Banks. I was down at the far end of the Eastern Shore. And it's so far in the Eastern Shore, they're now calling where we go the Outer Banks of Virginia.
Which, yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we said. Yeah, we've been coming here too long to fall for
that. Well, that's where we were driving through that Virginia area is when we see all the crepe myrtles along the highway.
Now, 20 years ago, I would have warned you that the crepe myrtle might not be winter hardy in Delaware. But the climate has warmed so much, and they've also gotten better at developing these plants, that you are in the safe zone. What's going to happen, it's a little bit like fig trees. You're going to plant it in a protected area, and it may suffer some winter damage, typically towards the top, but that's not an issue because you always want to trim it back early in the spring. And if you don't really want to make it much smaller, and we advise you not to, you just trim off the top foot. That takes care of the winter damage, and that'll improve your blooms. You know they won't bloom until the mid to late summer.
Yeah, from what I Googled, yes.
You might be able to get people to ship plants to you now. They would be specialty suppliers.
I could still plant this coming week, right?
Yes. Do you have one?
I've looked at one locally, and I'm going to go back once I figure out that I can plant it and how to plant it.
Was at the nursery?
Yes.
Excellent.
Outside of Wilmington. Yep.
Do you remember what kind? Now, there's various forms. There are standard crepe myrtles, if you remember, because you and I have driven down Route 13 many years, I think. Remember when the tall ones used to be there?
Yes.
Those were the standard crepe myrtles. They can get pretty tall. There are also dwarf varieties that stay a tidy 6 to 8 to 10 feet high, especially with regular pruning. And then there are also types that are more shrub-like than trees, which you probably saw some as you were driving around. So, and, of course, there's different colors. Do you know what color you have?
I think it's like a fuchsia. It's a little deeper than the pink.
Right.
Well, I think it's a Tuscarora.
Just remember that the red crepe myrtles won't bloom deep red if they don't get full sun.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Mike.
If they don't get a lot of sun, or sometimes if they even open up, if the flowers form during cloudy conditions, they'll be more pinkish than red. So you just have to be aware that these are full sun plants, and full sun means full sun no matter where they're grown.
Okay, well, when I plant it, if I plant it in a couple days, if I get one and plant it, will I have to shade it or water it
What you would do, you would follow the standard planting directions for a tree, which you should review on our website. You should go to You Bet Your Garden.
You got it.
And you should go to Garden Answers A to Z and go T for Tree Planting 101. But I'll tell you right now, remove any wrappings, plant it at the same height it was, either the soil line you see or the height it was in the pot, if it's in a pot, or slightly higher. Don't bury it. Don't put anything special in the hole to improve the soil. Just fill it back in with the lousy clay soil you removed. And then, after you're all done and you've made sure you haven't planted it too deeply, put a mulch of 2 inches of compost around the plant going out like a foot. And then, yes, if we don't get rain, water it deeply right away. Let a hose drip at the base of the plant for like 24 hours. Just drip, drip, drip. And then, and that's how you should continue to water it. Any week we don't get rain until we get frost, just let a hose drip at the base after that for several hours.
Wow. Okay.
And in the spring, if spring comes dry, water it deeply at the base for a couple of hours twice a week in the spring and summer. Any week we don't get rain, give it a nice light pruning in the spring when it starts to show new growth, and do that every year. And you should do fine.
Great.
The nice thing here is that plants like this that are installed in the fall have a much higher survival rate than in the spring.
Hey, Mike, thanks a lot.
Good luck, congratulations, and have fun with your myrtle.
All right, thanks, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the TEDx event, a local version of the legendary TED Talks, at the Colonial Theater in Phoenixville on Saturday, October 6th. And then I'll get you ready for fall planting and compost making at the Mount Laurel Green Fair at the Mount Laurel, New Jersey Library on Sunday, October 7th at 1 and 3 p.m. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and the best compost bins you can build or buy. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, the national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds gardeners that fall is the ideal time to plant gourmet garlic, perennial plants, bulbs for spring blooms, and especially fruit plants. More information at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY.
Temple University Libraries support WHYY and present lectures exploring the American idea. The series begins October 2nd with a conversation on sports and race featuring Larry Lester, a co-founder of the Negro League Museum, and Rebecca Alpert, author of Out of Left Field, Jews and Black Baseball. Other programs discuss art collecting, noir as an American genre, and more. These are open to the public with no ticket required. Complete schedule online at library.temple.edu.
Bartlett Tree Experts supports WHYY and offers the removal of hazardous trees and scientific treatments including pruning and disease diagnoses. Locations in Montgomery, Chester, and Bucks counties and Cherry Hill, New Jersey. More information at bartlett.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is almost time to begin harvesting all those priceless leaves for compost making. But what should you cook your compost in? We'll talk about the best bins you can build or buy later in the show. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Eric, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello there.
Hello, Eric. How are you, sir?
Oh, not too bad. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. And where is Eric not too bad?
I am not too bad in Anderson, Indiana.
What can we do for Eric in Indiana?
Well, I'm a self-proclaimed insufferable chili head. I've been chasing the hottest peppers I can for about 20 years now, and I've gotten to the point where I drive 2 hours to Cincinnati to go to Jungle Gyms just to get ghost chilies.
Oh, okay. And Jungle Gyms is a...
It's a nationally known, enormous, 5-acre international grocery store.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And you would like to ease your dependence on finding your way around these 5 acres and grow them yourselves?
Yes, I have tried to grow them at home, and I have also ordered seeds of the Trinidad scorpion variety. I'm trying to grow just, you know, maybe the top three hottest in the world, and I've done my research, I've looked at soil mix, I've gotten the heating mats, I've tried my best to follow the rules, and I can't get it right, and I just can't grow these things, and I'm wondering if there's a trick.
Yes, there is, and are you having trouble getting them to germinate happily and healthily to begin with?
Well, yeah, that's initially a problem, but if half the batch does manage to germinate, I've gotten them to about 2 or 3 inches tall, and they just kind of stagnate there, and that's it.
Okay, so here's the deal. You don't have a long enough climate to do these outside, but I think they should be outside during your summer. So my suggestion is we're going to start the seeds indoors, like over the holidays, like by the first of the year, you know, which would be 2-3 months ahead of when a normal person would start a normal pepper.
Okay.
One of the interesting things about the hottest peppers is that they have evolved to have a symbiotic relationship with birds. As you know, some of the hottest tiny peppers, ones that other people simply call ornamental peppers, the little bullet-shaped peppers, the marble-shaped peppers, are often referred to as a group as bird peppers. And they have all their fruits at the canopy of the plant, whether it's a small plant or a plant in the tropics that's been growing for 20 or 30 years, all the peppers are very at the top so that they attract birds with their bright colors. Birds then feed on the peppers. Birds are not bothered by hot peppers, and it's actually believed that it's a delicacy for them. And in the cold months, we can feed our birds hot peppers and help them actually stay a little bit warmer. So this way, for the peppers get transported to a different location. The bird sits on a fence post somewhere, and then to lighten its load for takeoff, it deposits the seeds and the birdie poop and starts a new pepper. So many of the world's hottest peppers need to go through the gut of a bird. And we can imitate that by soaking the peppers in bat guano. You'll soak them for like 24 hours in lukewarm water and bat guano. That will simulate the transport through the gut of a bird. And then what you want to do is you want to use just 100% of a loose light seed starting mix. You want a nice mixture of peat, perlite, vermiculite, and a little bit of compost in the bag, the professional mix that the professionals use. Use nursery six packs like they do. That's why they use them in the nurseries, because they're the perfect thing for this. And the heating mat, which is going to be essential, should be up at its higher level if it can be adjusted. These seeds tend to germinate in slightly higher temperatures, so where you might work a tomato at 70 degrees, hot peppers should be at 75 degrees. I'm just guessing on the heating mat. And if you can't adjust it, just remember, they do like it warm. It's very intuitive here. You know, make sure the seed starting solution stays saturated. Keep a loose plastic over top. Check them every day. As soon as you see the first sprouts, take the plastic off. You can leave them on the heating mat for another day or two to get the rest of the sprouts up. And then you have to move them under really bright light. You need either a shop light that is 4 feet long, fitted with 240-watt regular fluorescent bulbs. Or even better, if you want to do this, if you want to raise a lot of plants, get a four-tube, four-foot fixture and fit it with 40-watt bulbs, one cool, one warm white, and keep the tops of the plants almost touching the bulbs. People underestimate how much light new plants need to not grow up short and spindly. You want to keep them short and stocky. After they develop their first true leaves, you can feed them gently. Try to resist the temptation to overuse the bat guano now, because that's going to inhibit flowering. I want you to move to a balanced fertilizer, organic fertilizer, as soon as you can. When they get to be about 4 weeks old, you got to thin them out, just one per cell. When we get to around the time that it's time to put them out, I'm going to suggest you put them out in pots. Pot them up into nice, at least quart size, quart and a half, half-gallon pots. one plant per pot. Put them out where they're going to get really good sun, and don't put them out until the nighttime temperatures are staying reliably in the 50s. And then grow them over the summertime. You'll be starting with plants that are 2 months older, so I think you're going to be harvesting peppers by early September. And then as soon as the nights start to get cool again, as soon as they get down like below 55, that's when I want you to rinse the plants off real well with sharp streams of water, bring them back inside, and rig up the lights so that they can live inside. You can grow these same plants for 10 years. They are perennial as long as they're protected from frost. The first year, you're going to get a nice hoard of peppers. You do this right, they'll fruit and flower for you all winter long. The second year, the green stalk will have turned a little woody. You'll pot it up into a bigger pot, take it outside. By year three or four, these are going to be small trees that are going to be covered with more peppers than even you will know what to do with.
Oh, that's perfect. That's exactly what I want.
And I insist you go look up the publications of Dave DeWitt, D-E-W-I-T-T, who may have coined the term chili head, but he's the editor of Chili Pepper Magazine, and he has great books on growing chili peppers. He's the man who taught me.
Wow, I will do that. All right, thank you, sir.
Good luck, sir.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Brady, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing today?
I am doing well, Brady. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I appreciate you taking my call.
I appreciate your making it. Where are you?
I'm in Fort Payne, Alabama.
Okay. Which part of Alabama?
Fort Payne.
Oh, okay. And what area is that in Alabama? Top?
Northeast.
Northeast Alabama. All right. Very good. What can we do for Brady in Northeast Alabama?
Well, I got a row of Bradford pear trees that I planted up my driveway, and I planted the biggest one all the way at the end of the driveway. Well, now it's been like 2 years or 3 years now, and it's become the smallest. Right now, the leaves are almost all gone off of it, and the rest of them is still just beautiful green, and I don't know what's causing it.
You know, you're lucky in that these are the absolute cheapest trees you can buy. You know that. There is no cheaper tree to raise, sell, or buy.
Right.
And in Alabama, I'd worry about them during windstorms. Here in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, they get torn up by the least little bit of snow and ice. They are very weak trees. Now, when you bought them, were they bare root? Were they in pots? Were they bald and burlapped?
They were in pots.
So you took them out of the pots and you planted them at the same level that the pots were?
Yeah.
So have you ever done anything after you planted them? Did you ever mulch them? Did you ever feed them?
I just put mulch on them. That's the extent of, I mean, I fertilize my yard, and I guess it may get some in that, but just mainly mulch around them.
And what kind of mulch?
Just the red, like the...
Okay. That's going to kill all your trees sooner or later.
Really?
Oh, that's just trash. You know, that's just chipped up pallets from China that have been spray painted that god-awful color.
Oh. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And do you have the mulch actually touching the trees?
Yeah, it goes, I just spread them around it.
You can help that tree by hoeing the mulch back.
Okay.
Make sure it's not within 6 inches of the actual trunk. You want there to be air getting to the trunk of the tree at all levels.
Okay.
And
okay.
Can you see the root flare of the trees at all, or did you bury them like popsicles?
I don't see any of them. I mean, it's pretty much down in the ground. I mean,
right.
I didn't put them real deep, but, you know, I just put it to where the top is just right in the ground.
Well, most people plant too deeply. The trees always do better if you can see the root flare above ground. What you could do is you could give that tree a gentle feeding with compost, or not now because they're going dormant.
Right.
Although in Alabama, dormancy is, what, 3 weeks long? But I wouldn't feed them now no matter what. But
okay,
you could mulch it with compost if you can find compost. Keep your lawn chemicals as far away from the trees as you can.
Okay.
Especially if you use any kind of herbicides on your lawn.
Okay.
Because recently more and more lawn herbicides have been killing trees and shrubs. So keep the lawn chemicals especially away from this little runt. Make sure its trunk is exposed. Try to give it some compost. If you can find a mulch of compost, that would be great. Otherwise, okay, just get a gentle organic fertilizer that's designed for trees and shrubs and give it a little feeding in the spring.
Okay.
Doesn't sound like you're doing anything terrible to it.
Okay, well, I'm trying not.
All right, Brady?
All right, well, I appreciate it.
All right, good luck, sir.
All right, thank you.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, John. How are you?
Doing well. How about yourself?
I am very well, thank you. And where is John well?
I am in Wilmington, Ohio.
Wilmington, Ohio? That's like the wrong... How many Wilmingtons are there? My Wilmington is in Delaware. There's a Wilmington in North Carolina. Who are these Wilmingtons? Why are they all over the country? These are questions that need to be asked. What can we do for John and one of the many Wilmingtons?
We have a 10-acre patch, and I have about 10 trees on it. So I wanted to add some trees, and I just bought two apple trees. One's a Fuji apple tree, and one's a Granny Smith. And they're both about 8 feet tall. And I was wondering, my question was, is how should I stake them? Should I use a temporary stake or a permanent stake?
You're a man who has just complicated your life immensely. You realize that. are you growing fruit trees already? Have you grown fruit trees before?
We lived at a couple places. I just got out of the military. We rented some places that had trees already established, but I've never started them on my own.
Okay, so let me explain to you before we put these puppies in the ground. After they are established, after this next season to come, they will need to be really pruned back very hard at the end of winter, beginning of spring, just around the same time that they're flowering. And then the first year, you probably want to take all the apples off. And then the years after that, you need to remove at least 3/4 of the baby apples as early in the development process as possible to get good quality fruit. Then you'll see what kind of pests and diseases are troubling your apples, because you're not the only being that likes eating apples. There's lots of bugs and rots and squirrels, evil squirrels like apples, raccoons like apples. So you've adopted two children, and they're cranky children, John. So, but
I can do it.
The good, that's the man. Okay, so great time to plant these trees, by the way, in the fall. Congratulations on putting them in the ground now as opposed to the spring. What I want you to do, dig a wide hole, but not a deep one for each tree. You want to see the root flare, especially with apple trees. You don't want that tree to look like a popsicle once it's buried. You want to see the dramatic root flare above ground. Always better to plant high than low. You're okay. Not going to stake it. You're not going to strangle it. You're not going to kill it its first year. What you're going to do is refill the hole with the same soil you removed, and you'll tamp it down nicely. And then you'll set a hose to drip at the base of the newly planted tree for 24 hours, just a very slow drip. And then every week after that, until we get frost, let the hose drip for a couple of hours once a week if we didn't get good rains that week. Now, if you plant, we get a good soaking rain. You don't have to do any of this.
Now, is it okay if I get one of those tree bags and use that? Because where I'm going to plant them is probably 150 yards from the nearest spigot.
Yes, I think that would be good, because that would just kill these trees right away, and then we wouldn't have to worry about the future. These tree bags keep the trunk of the tree moist. That's the worst thing you can do for a tree. They give insects and mice and voles and other vermin a chance to eat away at your bark undetected. During the first couple of years of life, these trees are going to be very vulnerable to bark damage. You're not going to stake them. They don't need staking. Make sure they're not in an area of high winds where they don't get any protection from the wind, but they do not need staking. Staking is bad for young trees. What they need for you to do is buy tree guards, which are plastic or metal things you wrap around the trunk, especially low, to keep rabbits, mice, rats, voles, all these other creatures from eating the tender young bark, and to try and keep deer from eating the tree and from velveting their antlers against the bark. I really don't advise you to plant these things that far from a water source, because, you know, after they're established, they'll do fine. But for the first couple years of their life, you're going to have to be prepared to irrigate during dry times. What you might want to do is buy a rain barrel and get it out there near them, something to collect rainwater that you can use to irrigate them with gravity, if that's the only area you have. But that's awful far away for you to take care of these trees, too. You know, the further away the trees are from the house, the more the apples are going to be taken by wildlife.
Right.
So I would urge you to have them closer to the house for the care that they're going to need. You're going to get tired of going out to them. I mean, you'll be out there every day in the spring thinning apples once this gets good, if you want good apples at the end of the process.
Okay.
The closer they are to the house, the more apples you're going to eat. And go to our website, go to You Bet Your Garden, go to Garden Answers A to Z, and read two articles. The first is How to Plant a Tree, Tree Planting 101, and the other is Fruit Tree 101. That'll really help get you started.
All right. Appreciate the help.
Good luck on your great adventure.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and give full permission to those who would like to be done doing daycare for their tomato plants to pull those puppies out and replace them with salad greens, pansies, and or garlic. But don't destroy your pepper plants. They can be potted up and brought inside for the winter and many winters to come. But don't go looking for all the pepper perennializing details under the letter P in the A to Z Garden Answer section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and the best compost bins you can buy or build. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, the national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds gardeners that fall is the ideal time to plant gourmet garlic, perennial plants, bulbs for spring blooms, and especially fruit plants. More information at burpee.com.
And there's more of You Bet Your Garden straight ahead on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey. Presenting Christopher Durang's newest play, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, set in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. On a farmhouse in the country, siblings have their hands full with a prophetic cleaning woman, a costume party, and a surprise visit. Starring Sigourney Weaver and David Hyde Pierce, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike at McCarter Theater in Princeton, now through October 14th. More information at McCarter.org.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
Hey, if you're not planning to vote this year, we'd like to know why. Email beyondtheballot at whyy.org and tell us, and then tune in Monday afternoon at 1 as Dave Davies takes you beyond the ballot.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. The best compost bins you can build or buy. Composting time is coming soon. You need to be ready to contain your materials, and we'll tell you the best ways to do that after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Joanne. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing just fine, thank you. Where is Joanne good?
I'm in Crawfordville, Florida, just south of Tallahassee.
Oh, okay. I knew a young lady in college who was a Tallahassee lassie.
Oh, really?
Yes, yes. So what can we do for Joanne in northern Florida?
Well, I started a raised bed garden about 3 years ago, and it was very productive up until this past spring, summer season. I noticed that all the plants just weren't flourishing. The leaves were becoming discolored or even just falling off. And the fruits that I did get were small and misshapen. And that happened to my okra especially, my cucumbers, squash, pole beans, southern peas, everything. And so when I pulled the plants up, I saw that the roots had been attacked by the southern root knot nematode.
Oh,
and yeah, and I did a lot of research on these things, and they are a booger.
Yes.
And So I'm ready to start my fall garden, and I just don't know what to do, you know, if I should just completely move the whole setup or try to attack these things with these organic methods I've found online. And it just seems very labor intensive, and I'm not sure what kind of results I'm going to get.
I can tell you from my time as editor of Organic Gardening magazine back in the 90s, what a lot of Floridians would do when these destructive nematodes found their gardens is they would become container gardeners by default. They maybe, like you, may have built these great raised beds and then just wound up building closed boxes on top of them to keep the nematodes out. They are so pervasive. Northern listeners may be scratching their heads because I'm always recommending beneficial nematodes for certain soil-dwelling pests. And there's probably thousands of different species of nematodes. There's a couple that are beneficial. Most, like most creatures, are benign. They're just there. But the southern root knot nematode is such a destructive pest, you do realize that there are crops that have been bred to resist them. Have you looked into nematode-resistant crops? For instance, when you buy tomatoes, when you buy a pack of tomato seed or tomato plants in a six-pack, tomatoes that have been bred to resist certain problems will have letters after their names. The most common letters are V and F for verticillium and fusarium wilt. But the next one is typically N for nematodes, and there are many nematode-resistant varieties. Have you tried any of those?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I'm really into heirloom gardening, but I had an extra bed this year, so I had 4 heirloom tomato plants and 4 just hybrid Bonnie plants. The 4 hybrid plants that had this N on the little tag that you're talking about did not suffer the damage, but the heirlooms did. I'm aware of that, but I'd really like to stick to heirlooms.
Well, one thing I've noticed, for instance, is a hybrid version of Brandywine, and it's called Brandy Boy. And a friend of mine, it's his favorite tomato of all time, because the tomatoes are very much like Brandywine, but there's many more of them on a plant. You know, that's the rap against the old Brandywine, is it, you know, didn't produce a lot of tomatoes, but the ones that it did were miraculous. Well, Brandy Boy produces huge numbers of very similar tomatoes, and I think that's one of the trends now, is to hybridize these old heirloom varieties, try to keep the heirloom traits, but even a diehard heirloom enthusiast would say someone like you needs the help of a hybrid variety. You are the classic case of why hybrids are perfectly acceptable. And I think there are nematode-resistant cucumbers and other plants as well. Now, I will tell you, of all the organic techniques that have worked against root knot nematodes, there's 2 that I would recommend.
Okay.
The first, you'd have to wait until your really hot season, but it would be to solarize the soil. And I presume you've read up on that, where you clear the land, you level it out, you soak it till it can't hold water anymore, you stretch clear plastic over the top, and then you let that plastic bake for me for the whole summer. But where you are, I would say about 2 months, maybe maximum 3 months, and you would not only have baked all the nematodes out of the soil, you would baked any of those southern diseases, a lot of insect larvae, every weed seed. The investment there is time. The other is a magnificent trick. There were always these rumors about interspersed marigolds between your plants, and that'll keep root knot nematodes away. Well, as you may have figured out, it doesn't work. But if you buy marigold seed in bulk and sow your entire garden in marigolds and let them get to where there's a number of flowers open and plow them under, then no nematodes will live in that soil for 4, 5, 6 years going forward. And it really works, but you must plow the flowering plants into the soil. Resistant varieties will give you something to eat. It's specialty crops until you get the soil nematode free, grow them in containers. But then if you solarize some areas and you marigold some others, you can then go back to your heirloom varieties and grow them in that soil, especially in the soil that where the marigolds were plowed under. That's going to be safe to grow in for years to come.
Okie dokie then. Well, I sure appreciate it, Mike.
Good luck, Joanne.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine, Ron. How are you, sir?
I'm okay.
And where is Ron okay?
I am out of Philadelphia, but I have a question about a property in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware.
I know Rehoboth Beach really well. It is a beautiful area. It's the down the shore for the people from Washington, D.C.
Yep.
What can we do for Ron, who has a dual passport here?
Recently bought a property, and on it is a very large and old willow tree. And at the base, there is a hole developing. So on a very low part of the property, about a half acre, and it collects a lot of water in any rainstorm. But at the base of this pretty large tree, which I'd say about 30 feet tall, there is a hole at the base of the tree, and someone told me that I should cement the hole.
No, this is a very common phenomenon with older trees. I'm assuming that the look of the tree, the canopy of the tree, everything looks very healthy and happy.
Yes.
My strong advice to you is to do nothing.
Okay.
There was advice for many years that went around about sealing pruning cuts after you prune. That turned out to be terrible advice. There was advice to, when these holes appeared in trees, to like clean them out, fill them with insecticide, or paint them over with white latex or something like that. And the truth is that this is a very natural circumstance, and the trees are very good at working around it. The dangerous thing for a tree, any tree, is when the trunk is girdled. That is, when the complete circumference of the tree is injured by a scar. Let's say somebody was a dummy and put up a dog run and tightened it up against the tree, and over the years it cut into the tree. Just underneath the bark is, I think it's called the cambrium. It's the only real part of the tree that transports nutrients up to the canopy. Not the center of the heartwood, not the bark itself, but right underneath that bark, that's the superhighway that carries food and water up to the canopy. That's the important part. And you've seen trees. I've seen trees that have been hit by cars or trucks that have these huge gashes in their side. And the trees are not harmed by this. They can take a lot of injury. They are big honking trees, after all. So a hole on one side, as long as the canopy continues to fill out every spring, is no problem whatsoever. And it's virtually guaranteed that whenever humans try to improve on situations like this, they can move the tree into the choir invisible much faster.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And has it put on a beautiful display this spring and summer?
Yes, the very, very nice,
well,
typical willow tree.
Well, then it's telling you that, you know, it's got a bad knee. But that otherwise, it's very happy and healthy. Observe the canopy. Follow the rule of the canopy. If the top of the tree is happy, if it leafs out every spring, if it behaves the way it's supposed to all summer, if it does the right things in the fall, no matter what oddity it may have about it, and all trees have something like this, there's nothing wrong whatsoever.
Okay, great. Thank God I didn't cement it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, thanks a lot.
Now you can fill in the cracks in that broken pavement instead, Ron.
Yeah, right.
All right, take care, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. What kind of composter is best for you? We got a double-barreled question this week. You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, please read us the foist one.
Okay. Don in Lawrenceville, New Jersey writes, I want to build a better compost bin. Are there any designs that are award winners? If so, where can I find them?
Well, you'll find lots of plans online, at woodworking sites and in bulletins from state extension offices. But rather than try and rattle off long internet addresses, I'll describe two DIY designs that have stood the test of time and let you look up the directions that best suit your needs and skill levels. The first is the classic Lehigh bin, designed by J.I. Rodale, the founder of Organic Gardening magazine and the man who popularized composting in America. Working with researchers at Lehigh University back in the early 1940s, J.I. came up with a simple design that's never been bested. A 4-foot square cube that's 4 feet high, 4 feet deep, and 4 feet long, made of cedar slats, designed so that there's a cedar board, then an opening the width of a board, then another board, then another opening, and so on until the stack of slats reaches 4 feet high. Holes drilled into the edges of the boards at each corner allow four iron rods to slide down and hold everything stable. The openings between each slat maximize the airflow that reaches the cooking compost while requiring much less wood than a solid-sided design. A properly made Lehigh bin can even be folded flat for transport and then opened up on site like a cardboard box. The size was originally predicated on the length of lumber. You just have standard 8-foot boards cut in half, drill the holes, and you're in business. But it was later discovered that the 64 cubic foot capacity was also perfect for making high-quality compost. Although larger is always better. A Lehigh bin made from 8-foot lengths of lumber would be a compost-cooking monster. Now, the other big DIY design is the classic three-bin system, where you essentially line up three Lehigh bins in a row, ideally rigged so that the fronts of the bins swing open. You toss your raw material into the first bin until it's full, then fork it all over into the middle bin. When number one is again filled up with raw material, you move everything over one bin. When number one is filled the third time, the material in the last bin should be ready to use. The individual bins can be pretty much any size, and many designs incorporate side beams and roofs. Scott Meyer, another former editor of Organic Gardening magazine, came on our show a few years back to promote a design that's a great improvement on the traditional three-bin system. Using hardware cloth in place of wood for much of the structure, dramatically improving the airflow and reducing the cost. The good folks over at Organic Gardening have put that original how-to slideshow up at their website, and we'll provide a link to those directions with a printed version of this question of the week. All right, now we move on to question number two. Alexis?
Ayana in Ballackinwood, Pennsylvania writes, I would like to begin composting. Could you suggest a bin, one that comes ready to use as opposed to something I'd have to make, and some reference materials? I'm thinking of books by Mike McGrath, of course. Thanks very much.
Well, it may seem self-serving to recommend my 2006 bestseller, Mike McGrath's Book of Compost, as the instructional guide here. Okay, it is self-serving. I make a fast 17 cents every time somebody buys one. But one, it's easy to read and tells you everything you need to make and use compost successfully. Two, a lot of the other compost books out there seem to be theoretical exercises by people who have never actually made black gold from their garden trash. And three, you specified books by me, so it's either that or tomatoes. Anyway, if you want an open compost pile, you can buy pre-made versions of the Lehigh bin. There are also rolls of perforated plastic fencing designed to be unrolled and filled with your raw materials. Yes, this can also be achieved with any welded wire fencing, but the plastic roll-your-own design has smaller openings designed to keep the raw materials inside better. Sealed composters are often a better choice when neighbors are nearby and/or vermin are concerned. There are two versions of the black recycled plastic kind readily available. Both have lids that lock to keep out playful vermin and a removable panel at the bottom that allows easy access to the finished material. One, the Earth Machine, is round. Often offered at composting classes, it comes in two big pieces plus a lid, and so it doesn't ship very easily. The other, the Compost Digester, sold at retail and via mail order, is rectangular and breaks down into flat panels for easy shipping and transport. Both have open bottoms that allow entry to earthworms. And finally, there are the off-the-ground tumblers. These are generally made of metal and have either one or two drum-shaped compartments. They're completely vermin-proof and have a hand crank that allows you to turn the contents to move the process along faster. But the lack of ground contact means you won't have earthworms helping you out. Well, that sure was some interesting information about your compost containment options, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over carefully, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to exclude me from earthworm contact if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Like us on Facebook. Put the actual subject in the subject line. Like us on Facebook. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and or like us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Fearless Fred Snyder. Barbaric Rich Banowitz and Savage Sarah Kazar are the masters of our newly designed website. Amanda McGrath is our social media director. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Joanna Hatzis and Brent Rader are our production assistants. Al Banks is our esteemed editor, and I'm your host, Mike McGrath, holding you hostage. Like us on Facebook or you'll never hear funny credits again. Or at least until I see you next week. In the fall, every gardener's fancy turns to, no, not love, shredding leaves. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the easiest ways to turn this year's leaves into next year's success, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike Judiciously and John Teely jives about jasmine, Japanese beetles, jack-o'-lanterns, jonquils, thinking ahead to spring. Anyway, You Bet Your Garden comes your way Saturday mornings at 11 here on WHYY.
St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington supports WHYY. When someone is injured or ill, a long wait in the ER can be damaging. According to the Centers for Disease Control, average ER wait times are nearly 1 hour. St. Francis's Emergency Services Team has